Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation with David Wolman and Julian Smith. The occasion for our conversation was the release of their new co-written book, Aloha Rodeo. Aloha Rodeo is a book that belongs to an exciting category of nonfiction that unearths hidden history, explodes cliches, and tells a more complicated version of a story we think we already know. In this case, it is the story of the American West and some of the greatest cowboys who ever lived, and they are from Hawaii. Yes, they're from Hawaii, which, it turns out, has a rich history of cattle wrangling that is, in fact, older than the traditions of America's Great Plains. This is the tale of how three of the island's most revered cowboys journey to Wyoming at the turn of the century and win at the largest, most important rodeo in the world, stunning the competition and the crowds, and upending assumptions about the American frontier. In this conversation, we hear about how and why Hawaii came to have cattle at all, and learn about the vibrant culture and industry that evolved because of them. The authors explore the reasons why the tale of the Hawaiian cowboys has been expunged from mainstream history and how they went about trying to recenter these incredible athletes. It is a fascinating conversation that tells the tale of two places that are not normally associated, Wyoming and Hawaii, and will make you rethink what you think you know about the Wild West. I sat down with Wolman and Smith in May 2019 for a live event at Powell's Books.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks very much to Powell's. It's awesome to be in like the greatest bookstore in the galaxy. And thank you, David and Julian, for joining us tonight. And thank you all for spending your evening with us. We're going to talk for about 45 minutes. We'll take some questions, and then there'll be a huge signing line out this side. I think what's exciting about the book is this belongs to a category of books that are part of the sort of untold history of the United States, stories that have been maybe forgotten through convenience or simplicity, possibly through bigotry. They've done a beautiful job of excavating an important story that complicates the story of the American West. It redefines what a cowboy is. It certainly redefined it for me. Cowboys are not the cultural product of the American West, as we are often told, but cowboys are an international phenomenon, North and South America, and of course, the Pacific Islands. It's a story that explodes a lot of cliches, and it's about two worlds colliding, one from Hawaii and one from Wyoming. It's a total page-turner. It's completely cinematic. You guys all have to read it. It's fantastic. So with that, I want to just ask... So good night. So I do want to see that first slide, because it's an amazing slide. And I want to ask David just to talk about who this is, who the statue is, and why it's important to this book particularly.
This is a statue of a guy named Ikua Purdy. The statue sits outside of a small shopping complex in the town of Waimea, on the island of Hawaii. And Ikua is really one of the stars of our story. And he is one of the Hawaiian cowboys who, in 1908, traveled 4,000 miles from Hawaii to compete in Cheyenne Frontier Days in the steer roping competition of what was indisputably the greatest rodeo in the world. And he came home with the prize. He won it, and his cousins came in third and sixth place. And we tell the story of these three guys.
At the same time as these guys were coming up, what is happening in Wyoming at the time, before this pivotal moment happens? Can you talk a little bit about that transition period where the book takes place?
Yeah, so the late 19th century was kind of the boom time, the classic cowboy wranglers getting everybody up from Texas to Wyoming, the big cattle drives. And Cheyenne was kind of in the forefront of that boom. Cheyenne was just a little dusty town down in the southeast corner of the state, but it also had all these grasslands nearby, and they were still wide open back then, and it had links to rails, and trains to the back east so they could sell the cattle products. So Cheyenne had this incredible, really short, but incredible boom in about the 1880s. And by some accounts, it was actually the wealthiest city of its size in the world. They had an opera house, they had clubs, they had everything. And then the market basically collapsed almost overnight. It was a combination of, it was a really terrible winter in 1886. that left a lot of cattle dead. And it was just the changing of the frontier. The frontier was ending at this time. And it was a really interesting time in American history because it was like the passing of the Wild West. And they were conscious of it. They saw this lifestyle, this way of life, this gestalt, whatever you want to call it, that was totally unique and really captured the imagination of people around the world. But they could see it fading. You know, it was the invention of the car, the invention of the airplane, moving pictures, all these huge changes were happening. And so it was basically a transition from the Wild West, from the reality of what it was, to the myth of what it was. And all this was happening at the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, when our story happens.
That's great. So in our conversation, we're going to bounce between a little bit between Hawaii and Wyoming and until they finally meet, if you like. And so maybe, Julian, I think you're going to read a little bit from the book. And this takes place right at the beginning of the book and takes place, it's set in Hawaii. And if you want to just set it up just a little bit, that's fine. But it's an amazing and a beautiful passage.
All right, so the setup for this is the first cattle arrived in Hawaii at the very end of the 18th century. They were a gift from the British, and they were genuinely a gift, but they were also basically a tool of imperialism. The British were trying to make the rest of the world like Britain. So they brought their goods, they brought their animals, but in Hawaii, the Hawaiians had never seen anything like these cattle. They were longhorns from what's now the southwest of the United States. They had these 6-foot horns, they were just huge, ornery animals. And even though the first couple didn't even make it to shore alive, pretty soon, these first dozen or so multiplied. There was a royal edict that you couldn't touch them. They all belonged to the king. So they just ran rampant around the islands. They multiplied insanely. And pretty soon, there were thousands of wild cattle. They didn't belong to anybody. And they just kind of took over the place. And the Hawaiians had a real problem on their hands. So that's kind of the setup here. The main character, John Palmer Parker, was a really instrumental figure in the book. He was from Massachusetts, but he ended up settling in Hawaii and starting this ranching dynasty that still continues today. When Parker settled in Hawaii, the wild cattle situation was completely out of control. Thousands of animals roamed wherever they pleased, with virtually no fences or stone walls to stop them. They raided agricultural plots that Hawaiians had painstakingly cleared of heavy volcanic rocks and fertilized with seaweed and manure. For foraging cattle, farm plots were a veritable buffet. To a distant observer, the west coast of the island looked unchanged from 3 decades earlier when European explorers made their first contact. A coastline dotted with thatched roofs, fishermen working the reefs, and taro plots spread out below leafy slopes. But elsewhere, especially in the upland plateau north of Mauna Kea, cattle were creating chaos and endangering lives. Visiting foreigners noted that the animals had resorted to the mountains and become so wild and ferocious that the natives were afraid to go near them. That's a quote. For centuries, this part of Hawaii, known as Waimea, had been a carefully guarded landscape of green hills, fertile farms, and grasslands bordered by thick forests to the north. Cows would change all of that. The thriving newcomers acted as if they owned the place. These were not the docile, doe-eyed animals of eastern dairy farms. Longhorns were the same breed of cattle that wranglers in Alta California would sometimes pit against grizzly bears for sport. Hawaii's cattle had quickly become shrewd survivors who hid and foraged in steep pockets of forest and remote ravines. Like mountain lions, they tended to avoid people as much as possible, except when it was time to storm a garden. If startled or threatened, they would charge and chase anyone in sight. In the early 19th century, a Russian merchant sloop arrived at Kailakakua and found the area overrun with wild cattle. One of the Russian explorers wrote of a herd that came down from the mountains and, quote, committed great ravages in the plantations in the valleys. A large group of Hawaiians was dispatched to catch the animals, or at least scare them away. The cattle killed 4 men before disappearing back into the hills. The situation was similar on Oahu, Maui, and soon Kauai and Molokai, too. Fences did little to prevent what one historian dubbed the Great Cattle Menace. By 1830, there were an estimated 20,000 wild cattle on Hawaii alone. The animals made it difficult to clear and farm the land and made it hazardous to venture into the high country. "The bullocks of the mountains were very numerous and savage," wrote an American traveler in 1841. "So that traveling among the mountains was attended with great danger." Another visitor, keen to explore Mauna Kea and its surroundings, found Hawaiians were, quote, "so terrified at the idea of encountering the wild cattle which roam in prodigious numbers through the woods that no threats or entreaties would be likely to induce them to penetrate far into the forest with you." In less than a quarter of a century, Vancouver's gift had become, in the words of a British explorer, completely furae naturae. There were a few scattered attempts at fencing and domestication. The native governor of Hawaii ordered the construction of a stone wall nearly 5 miles long to prevent cattle from trampling farms. On Oahu, an enterprising Spaniard named Don Francisco de Paula Marin may have been one of the first people in the kingdom to slaughter cattle and sell the beef. By 1828, Marin's herd was up to 1,000 animals. A former slave from the United States was reported to have a flock of goats and a handful of dairy cows inside a round fence on a 6-acre homestead near Waikiki. For the most part, though, the animals remained wild and dangerous.
So that's the beginning of cattle on Hawaii, and of course later things changed radically. But before we get into that a little bit, I want to ask David just to talk about like uncovering the story. What's the story like behind the story of this book, and how did you find it?
So this began for me with a vacation. When I first saw the Ikuwa Purdy statue and read what I think was maybe 3, possibly 4 sentences about this guy, and that in 1999 he had been inducted into the Rodeo and Cowboy Hall of Fame, I immediately had like a million questions. You know, who was this guy, and what was this experience like for him, and who did he travel with, and what was that voyage like all the way from Hawaii to post-earthquake San Francisco, and then taking the train all the way to Wyoming, and how were they received there? And you know, I didn't jump on my laptop right there and then because it was vacation, but it was eating at me a little bit. And when you feel this kind of upwelling of questions about a subject, you wonder, oh man, maybe I'm onto something. But you don't really know early on like that. And there are so many orphaned ideas that don't go anywhere. And so what happened is, you know, Julian and I think we'll talk a little bit later about co-writing the story in another one, but I was telling him about it a little bit, and we decided to spend a couple weeks poking around looking for some information. And that's when, you know, once you start to peel back the onion layers, that's when it really blossomed. It just looked like this wonderful story that we could chase after, because we saw, as Julian was mentioning, such an interesting time in Wyoming then, and then also in the islands. This is just a little more than a decade after annexation, which is a really important time for Hawaii and Hawaiians. We also found a sports rivalry that we could then, instead of being sort of a one-hit wonder about one moment in steer roping history, now we have this this temporal element. We can follow these two competitors through time. And Wyoming superstar, his name was Angus McPhee, which is an awesome name all by itself. And he was 5-time steer roping champion. And so we set it up in the book that these are sort of the two rivals competing to be the best in the world. And, you know, I think between those elements of sort of the political context of the time, Angus McPhee, and then thinking about what resource material might be out there, that's when we set about to write a book about it.
Well, and can you say a little bit about why now? Why is now important for this book and this story, do you think?
I mean, I think it's always the time to reveal hidden stories or stories that have been lost to most people. You know, in Waimea, they know this story in broad strokes, but elsewhere, nobody knows this. So I would argue that it's always time to showcase stories like that. But, you know, now more than ever, I think we need these kind of stories because of the very plain truth that diversity just makes us better and makes our stories better. You know, in this time when xenophobes are emboldened and bigots are everywhere, and we don't have to get too political, but this kind of story just reminds you that worldview and that view of what makes America great is silly. And it's stories like this that we should be celebrating. No more politics, I'm sorry about that.
No, I mean, it's important to address head on, I think, because also, you know, I think the book very sensitively acknowledges the role of Native peoples throughout the story, and maybe you guys could say a little bit about, both in Hawaii and in Wyoming, how you approach that question as people who are not Native peoples.
Mm-hmm. I'll start on that. We were thinking about this a lot, and really from the outset. We definitely wanted to be participating in this conversation of upsetting conventional thinking about the American West and sort of poking it in the eye of that simplistic binary black and white view of things. But how do you participate in that discussion in a way without commandeering someone else's story in light of the fact that that's not your own history? How do you write it in a way where it's conversational? It's not me and Julian telling you exactly how to view the world and how to view these issues. Because I didn't want to write a thing that, that sounded like my word on this is the final word on this. And one of the things that we set out to do was just to really keep each other on notice all the time about this question, about our own bias, about our own privilege. And we also did our best with what it was often pretty one-sided material in the historical record. So, for example, if you were to believe the journals of Captain George Vancouver, we know the very day that cattle first arrived in the islands, and that's amazing. But we also know that those accounts are all written by white mariners. And those accounts of the Hawaiians responding so wildly and in a frightened manner to these mammals that they'd never seen before. So then what do you do? What do you do with that documentation? And the challenge for us was to sort of mine that material gently. And what could we use that would help tell the story but wouldn't be falling into some of these old traps and tropes? So that was one thing we did. And then on the sort of research and writing side, then on the editing side, it was really important for us to stay in very frequent contact with experts we had befriended in the islands who were scholars of Paniolo history. Paniolo is Hawaiian for cowboy. Or Hawaiian language scholars or Hawaiian culture experts. When we're editing the book, they're probably so annoyed with us in our emails by this point, but we're asking them about certain details or ideas or even a whole passage to sort of keep ourselves in check. And I had a conversation with one of the descendants of one of the protagonists in the book, because those were people we also really relied on for a lot of this material. And, you know, he's now a PhD candidate at UPenn. And we had a call last winter. And I was pretty nervous about it, to be honest. I was worried that he might be upset with this project for whatever reason. But instead, he really just thanked me. He thanked us for diving in, and as he put it, like for doing the work to unearth all of the detail for this story, a story he grew up hearing in Hawaii, but only in really broad strokes. And so, you know, he's just one guy, it's just one opinion, but it was very validating for me in the moment that maybe we did a half decent job with this thing. You wanna talk a little about Cody and?
Yeah, on the Wild West end of things, it can definitely be a minefield if you're not careful, the cultural angle. I mean, especially this portrayal of the American West was, you know, they say history is written by the victors, and a lot of it was. And that's just something we had to keep in mind, like Dave was saying, over and over, reviewing these primary sources, including the newspaper accounts of when these Paniolo arrived in Cheyenne. It was very interesting to hear how they were treated. I mean, they weren't mistreated, but they were definitely the other. They were the outsiders. And especially interestingly, Hawaii had been a part of the United States for over a decade, but a lot of people didn't even know that, and they called them foreigners. There was kind of this vaguely patronizing attitude, these guys are here, that's cute, they're nice, but they're not gonna make a difference. So, and on the Buffalo Bill angle, one of the, back when I was talking before about the transition from reality to myth of the American West, probably the one person who was most responsible for that was Buffalo Bill Cody, who was at the time probably the most famous person on the planet. He was the first kind of mega superstar. And that was because of this traveling show he organized with hundreds of people, including Native Americans, a lot of former soldiers. They reenacted famous battles like Custer's Last Stand. You know, they had the classic Native Americans chasing the stagecoach. They had real buffalo. They had Sitting Bull, the Sioux chief. So it was a really fascinating mix of real and myth, because of course their portrayals of all these events, which sometimes included people who had actually been involved in these battles, which happened, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, were completely told from the white man's perspective. So that's a balance we really had to kind of be careful of, but it made the book and writing the book so much more interesting and a rich experience.
Well, it's amazing to think that at its peak, 20,000 people went to that frontier show. I mean, that must have been a percentage of the population of the United States at that time almost. I mean, it's an incredible number to think about. 20,000 people now at something is a big number. But let's go a little deeper into like the process of writing this book, because I was, you know, co-writing books typically are about ghostwriting, right? There's a celebrity and then a ghostwriter who really does all the work. But you guys actually shared the load 50-50, which I think is astonishing, because not only is the book a beautiful and it really, you know, but it's seamless. I mean, I could not tell when we were transitioning from one writer to the other. So, I mean, I think it's hard for one writer to pull that off. I think it's an incredible feat of writing that you guys sort of wove the book together so seamlessly. Can you talk a little bit about the researching and the writing? And this is a pretty unusual partnership, so I think it's worth talking about a bit.
Yeah, like you're saying, it's actually pretty rare to find books that are actually co-written. I mean, we were looking around before we were considering doing this, you know, asking people what it was like, and there's hardly anybody out there. Usually, like you're saying, it's the ghostwriting situation, which my book before this, the Smoke Jumper book, that was the situation. It was some other person's story, but I wrote the whole thing. But Dave and I had obviously been friends for a long time, colleagues, and we had co-written an article a few years ago about warring ice cream truck drivers in Salem called The Cold War, which is, it's a great story. So we knew we could work together well. You know, we both had thick skin and we could be pretty honest with each other. But when we embarked on this book, that was definitely something that we were very aware of. You know, on the plus side, it can mean less work to do because there's somebody else to share the burden. We definitely wrote it quicker than it would have been had it been a solo job. But you also have to balance sometimes two different approaches. So for this book in particular, this story, we were pretty lucky that the story itself divides organically, roughly, into two separate parts. There's the Hawaii part and the Wyoming part. So for the first draft, at least, that's how we split things up. Dave became the expert in all things Hawaii, and I kind of dug into the Wild West Cheyenne stuff. And that seemed to work pretty well. So in terms of the first drafts, that's how we did it. But then from then on, it was like an endless tennis match, back and forth, rewriting. So by the end, there's not a full sentence in this book probably that either of us can say, this is mine. And we're still friends, so we did something right.
Fantastic.
I'll just add a thought or two. I mean, because I don't think it would work for all books, but Julian's absolutely right about that kind of natural division of labor, at least for the first section. And another thing I think that we benefited from co-writing is, you know, in my view, like the prose ended up to be really lean and kind of fat-free because it's like having an editor there all the time. You know, when you submit a book manuscript, like you haven't even really talked to that editor in months, and then they read the thing and then they take too long to get it back to you, and then you take another stab at it and they take too long to get it back to you, and eventually you have this thing that you did alone. But we were really scrutinizing each other's creations, I guess, and pretty darn ruthless when it came to critiquing one another. But you know, when I reread parts of it now, I'm just really happy with how it turned out, and that that all of that extra stuff is gone, because some stories you don't need 400 pages to tell a good yarn, and so good work, Julian. Good work.
All right, so maybe Julian, would you advance that slide, and Dave, would you turn to page 90 in that book? Oh, this is a shot. Actually, explain this shot before we get to the passage. Could somebody talk about
this?
What's
is at
here?
A hill station on the Big Island of Hawaii on one of our research trips. We went up and spent 3 or 4 nights up at this hill station where, you know, it was a spot where the Paniolo we were writing about actually spent some time. So we got to see the environment they worked in, just how incredibly tough the landscape was. These lava tubes, the jungles, the mist, it's cold, it was hot, you know, it was a lot colder than you'd think. But we also got to interact, we were really fortunate to interact with some real experts in the history of Paniolo, and actually a few actually real Paniolo themselves, a couple of old guys, and also some of the new generation of natural resource managers who were there, who were really lucky and really appreciative of being there with kind of the old guard who was handing down this incredible body of knowledge. This guy here, he was some kind of natural resource manager who was probably in his 30s and hanging out with these 80-year-old guys that had spent their entire lives doing this stuff, getting to know this environment like the back of their hand. So this was, it was a really lucky break that we got to be able to be a part of this. And yeah, it was a lot colder than you think.
Right. And would you click it one more time? Because I think it's another, yeah, this is a great slide. Now, Dave, I'm going to ask you to read, and maybe not even set this up, just get into that page 90, which this is my favorite. They're indulging me a little bit, because it's one of my favorite passages in the book, and it's just an astonishing description, and that slide kind of says a lot about it too.
Once they made it to the coast, there remained one more step in the wrangling process, the one that truly put the Paniolo in their own category, herding into the surf. Because harbors like Kauai High were too shallow for large ships, the steamships that ferried the cattle to the slaughterhouse in Honolulu or to markets overseas had to anchor out past the reef. So the island's cattle, after surviving the arduous drive from the highlands to the shore, now had to swim. One at a time, Paniolo roped bullocks around the neck and led them down to the beach. Eyeing the waves like surfers, the riders carefully counted the breakers until the right moment came to plunge forward, cow in tow. Thinking they were being given one last chance to catch a cowboy, bullocks would usually charge straight toward the waves after the horse and rider. If they refused to step into the sea, a second cowboy had to grab the animal's tail and pull it sideways until the waves started to knock it over, which usually convinced it to swim. Past the breakers, the cowboys had to steer his horse, now shoulder deep, or more often swimming, toward a whaleboat approaching the shore. He threw the rope to one of the crewmen, who pulled the animal in, put a halter around its neck, and tied it to the gunwale before tossing the Paniolo his rope back. Soaked in sweat and salt water, the cowboys turned to shore to do it all over again. For this work, Paniolo used specially trained shipping horses that were larger and more confident swimmers, and rode saddles that were mostly made of wood, which lasted longer. Still, no amount of specialized equipment or training guaranteed successful or even safe operation at the shore. Bad timing with a wave, or a moment of fumbling by the whaleboat crew, could end with a horse upended in the surf, putting both animal and rider in peril. And then there were the sharks. The reefs that protected the harbors used for loading cattle were favorite feeding grounds for marine predators. On loading days, sharks sometimes congregated near the whaleboats, nosing for steak tartare. Sailors used rifles to scare them away, even dynamite on occasion. One May morning in 1884, Sam Parker, John Palmer Parker's grandson, was helping load cattle onto a steamship at Kauai High. The work was going well when, in a blur of teeth and blood, a massive shark suddenly bit a swimming calf in two. This could not stand, and the men in the whaleboat gave chase. They managed to stick a harpoon in the shark, But even then, it dragged the boat through the waves like a child's toy, a Hawaiian version of the Nantucket sleigh ride that New England whalers described after harpooning a humpback. Finally, the exhausted shark relented. Parker and the cowboys used their lassos to haul the monster to shore and onto the beach. A quick measurement showed it was 18 feet long and almost 6 feet around. Parker cut off its head to keep as a souvenir. To load the big ships, Paniolo brought animals out to the whaleboat one at a time until it had 6 or 8 attached. The crew then rowed to the steamship, flanked by swimming cattle. To lift them onto the ship, Paniolo had to fit each bullock into a crude lifting harness. The process required at least one man to be in the water with the animals, clinging to each one's back to affix a sling under its belly. Inevitably, cattle were sometimes hurt or drowned. Others would get loose and swim for freedom. On one occasion, a bullock escaped its harness and plunged into the ocean. A witness recalled how a cowboy, quote, stripped down to his breeches and started off after the steer. In rough seas, a mile from shore, he swam to the animal, quote, dived under it to get the sling rope untangled from his forelegs. Then he climbed onto the steer's back, lay down along its spine, took the horns in his hands, and steered that animal ashore by hand pressure on the horns. The cowboy was Ikua Purdy's uncle, James. Hazards aside, the life of a Paniolo also offered unequaled freedom and adventure. For those who thrived on the satisfaction of doing a difficult job well, on their own terms, there was no better work than running cattle. This was as true in Hawaii as it was anywhere. Even the moments of greatest danger were balanced by a sublimity that could inspire a cowboy to a kind of poetry. One Paniolo described the hyper-alert, almost enchanted moment of the hunt, when, in his words, the mind is calm, ready. You hear the whispered command, you mount up and ride down over the rim, down, down, through the swirling fog and clutching brush. No need for silence now. Just watch which way those wily cattle are going to turn, away from you, right at you, head and horns set for the charge. Your pony steps aside, your hand flips a loop over the horns, you take up slack, and your pony is turning, watching that rope, and you're running beside the captive, then ahead of it, that beautiful wild one. These are the words of Eben Lowe, one of Hawaii's most famous Paniolo, a man who would almost single-handedly introduce island cowboys and ranching to the wider world.
It's fantastic. It's so beautiful. I mean, yeah, for sure. I don't know that I'd ever thought I'd ever hear a story about sharks and cowboys in a coherent story. So that alone is amazing. So was that, I mean, what is the most surprising thing about the research in this book? Is it that moment, or are there other moments where you were just couldn't believe what you were reading and finding?
To me, the most incredible thing about the book, the most fascinating, was just the daily job that these guys did in Hawaii running cattle. I mean, the cowboy has kind of mythology around him already. You know, it's supposed to be a super tough job, dangerous, but these guys did stuff that it's still unbelievable to think about, having spent a year or more immersed in this. They were doing the cattle roping and chasing and finding in dense jungles, and up on the slopes of a volcano where, you know, it went from 100 degrees to 50 degrees in the blink of an eye. There were lava tubes, collapsed lava tubes, pits that they used to trap the bullocks in all over the place. They had to find these steers, not get gored by them, on horseback, rope them, and run them down the hills and try and keep some semblance of order with these monsters, basically, that were just trying to kill them. And the Eben Lowe that Dave mentioned is a great example of just one of many examples of the hazards that these guys faced. One day he had roped a bull and was running it down through the jungle and suddenly noticed that he was going on one side of a tree and the bull was going on the other side of the tree, and the rope was attached to his saddle horn. And in a split second, he knew that if he didn't do something, he was just going to get cut in half by this lasso. So he made this desperate maneuver, threw it over his head, saved his life, but in the process got his hand caught between the rope and the saddle horn. And with a 2,000-pound animal going 30 miles an hour on the other end, you can imagine what happened. So, and then, as we were saying, that wasn't the end of it. They had to take them out of the jungle across these barren lava plains where there wasn't any water for hours, days sometimes. And then they had to do this stuff on the beach, day in, day out, little or no medical care. And somehow they loved it, too. So to me, that was the most interesting part of the whole book, I think.
One thing that was pretty captivating to me and that I definitely didn't know beforehand was this idea that cattle, you know, the humble cow and bull plays a very significant role in the history of this place and even in the history of imperialism. It's just, that struck me as totally bonkers at first. But that is exactly what was happening. You know, they wanted to make these places a little more like Great Britain. And I also didn't really have an appreciation for the magnitude or the significance of cattle culture in the islands. You know, I think a number I came across that really stuck with me was that in the year 1900, roughly a third of all the acreage of the islands of Hawaii were allocated toward rangeland. And, you know, that really underscores this point that, of course, is running through the whole book for us, that this is just not a place, not only a place of white sandy beaches and palm trees and surfboards, that it has this rich ranching and cowboy tradition, but even I didn't realize it was quite that significant until I came across that kind of number. And then there's a few other points in the book where, you know, even disputes over cattle lead some very influential foreigners in Honolulu to try and pull strings to make their governments back home take over the islands. And so you have these moments of Hawaii almost losing its sovereignty in the mid-1800s, not when it finally did, over a fight over a cow. And, you know, that's just not anything I had ever come across before in my life.
Well, and there's also an interesting Oregon story in this book. So I wondered if one of you could talk about Dick Stanley and his role in the whole narrative.
Sure. There was a couple of Oregon connections. There was actually Hawaiian herders in Oregon at the time. If you've ever heard of the Owyhee River, that out in the eastern desert, that was a version of Hawaii. It was named after a couple Hawaiians who had set up shop out there. But the most direct connection was one of the side stories we came across as we were doing the research for the 1908 Frontier Days. And that was one of the really fun parts of this book is once you start digging into these histories and the newspaper accounts, you find all these side branches of the story that you really have to kind of rein yourself in or else you start going down this side road that just entrances you. One of the stories that we found that is actually in the book was while this big competition was going on in the cattle roping, there was also an amazing two-man rivalry going on in the bucking bronco competition. And these two riders were riding this horse named Steamboat, who was a legend. He had been being ridden for probably 10 years. Cowboys called him the worst horse they ever rode. You know, you hear these stories about guys waking up on the ground and having no memory beyond getting on the horse. You know, they couldn't eat for days after getting thrown by this monster. So there was two cowboys who were in this mano a mano rivalry to see who could win and who could ride this horse Steamboat. And one of them was named Dick Stanley. And he actually hailed from Portland. He had set up shop here after bouncing around the West with his brother. They set up a Wild West show. And he made this last minute journey all the way to Cheyenne to compete in the bucking bronco competition. He barely made it there in time, literally like hours before he showed up. And he did pretty well. And after that, his story gets even weirder because his name wasn't Dick Stanley and he was wanted for murder. So this is one of many, many side branches that we all almost think could make their own book and make another article, but it was really good to have Dave there to kind of rein me in and say, yeah, you know, maybe half a page on this, not three pages.
We're going to take a few questions, just a few minutes, but I want to ask just to wrap up our time together on stage. Like in 2 minutes, what would you each want readers to come away from after reading this book? What do you want them to read and understand and know better?
Well, first, I want you to be entertained. I mean, this is a great yarn. It's an underdog sports story. It's a little known story that we tried to bring into high def and set this, what we think is a really interesting context for these sporting events. So enjoy it. That would be great all by itself. But I also think we should all keep in mind that there are these amazing hidden stories out there like this. And just because you have bumped into a plaque that has 3 or 4 sentence summary of something that happened doesn't mean it's been done. And instead, maybe that should be incentive to go read some more about it. And you know, it's been such a delight to just keep kicking over stone after stone with this project and find so much fascinating information that maybe that will be something that happens to all of you. And when you get a little bit curious about something out there, or you just feel like question after question, you want to go learn some more, you should go do it and write a book.
Another thing that we really hope people come away with is the idea that, to put it as bluntly as I can, that history is a lot more complex than we usually think. I mean, the narrative of especially the American West and Hawaii too, you know, it's natural to want to simplify these stories. You know, clear good guys, clear bad guys, you know, a certain string of events. But once you start digging into it, you find how much more complex and rich it is. It might not be as easy to digest. It might not be as black and white. It might not make the best soundbite. But, you know, these stories are so much more, there's so much more going on than most of us know. And especially in the sense of this book, it was really in a cultural sense. You know, we've talked about that a little bit, but I mean, at heart, this is basically a story about diversity and the strength of diversity and people of all races, all genders coming together in this story that hopefully overturns a lot of these misperceptions, myths, simplifications, but in a good way. You know, that has you coming away saying, wow, that's even more interesting and complicated than I thought.
And inspiring. Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to ask if there are some questions as we get them. We're going to have time for 2 or 3. I would ask you to ask a question. And maybe not a 5-part question, but we'd love to hear if you've got questions about Aloha Rodeo. Is there anybody out there who got something they want to ask? Somebody right in the back there? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so the question is, can you tell us a little bit about the showdown in Cheyenne without giving away the end?
Yes. Maybe. Well, to give it a tiny bit more context, in 1907, so the year before our big matchup, the thing that set this whole thing in motion is that Eben Lowe, the one-armed cowboy, impresario, kind of Will Rogers of Hawaii, he was traveling on the mainland and ended up visiting Cheyenne Frontier Days and watching the steer roping competition. And he sat there in the stands and essentially thought, my cousins could beat these guys. And what happened is before the festivities even ended, Eben Lowe corners some of the Wyoming cowboys and invites them to Honolulu for a rodeo that he's hosting in December of 1907. Angus McPhee is one of them. And what's wonderful about McPhee's story, and this goes back to what Julian says, that sometimes these, you know, things aren't quite so binary, or history isn't as neat and tidy as we want it to be sometimes. Angus McPhee leaves a blizzard in his home state of Wyoming, comes to Honolulu, and experiences the weather there in those first couple days or even hours, and he never leaves. He stayed. And there still is like the sports rivalry element coming up, especially because steer roping competition is primarily against the clock, not like a boxing match necessarily. So our heroes go on this journey that we try to document in the summer of 1908, and then they get to Cheyenne, and we try and write about what we know from the historical record about how they were treated there. And without giving away the ending, one thing that is really fun to watch is this sort of changing tenor of the newspaper coverage, because at first, they are treated as these oddities, these outsiders, but people in Cheyenne are kind of proud. I mean, what better illustration that we have the biggest and best rodeo in the world than the fact that people are traveling from 4,000 miles away to come compete. So there was this sort of hint of pride. And they were sort of welcoming the Hawaiians, but with this caution mixed with, I don't know, a kind of puzzled expression, almost like they were a circus act and nothing more. So that's almost chapter one of the coverage. Then you see chapter two, after the Hawaiians perform really well on day one of the competition, there's this huge shift in the writing. I mean, it's kind of this vengeance-laced sports writing. It's like, okay, well, that was all well and good. Now, Wyoming native sons, it's time to send these Hawaiian guys packing. And of course, that is not how it transpired.
There was another question I think I saw over here somewhere. Yeah, go ahead. All right. The question is, what is it about sports that helps, and correct me if I'm wrong, what is it about sports that makes this an American story, or what is it about sports that make American stories that help tell them? Yeah.
I think there's something in the, what do you want to call it, the American character, the American experience, that's very individual and at the same time competitive, cutthroat sometimes. So the sports narrative of the very clear scoring and winners and losers is something that we tend to gravitate towards, I think. But, you know, like we were saying, it's interesting to contrast that. You know, contrast the results of a roping competition in Cheyenne, which is measured to the tenth of a second, and there's no question about who came in first or last, against this much more complicated gray area collision of cultures that's going on too. And like Dave was saying earlier, basically redefining what being an American means. I mean, it was really interesting, even some of the Hawaiian newspapers had that distinction between our boys and the Americans. And Hawaii was literally part of the United States for over a decade when this happened. But certainly everybody in the United States did not look at the Hawaiians as Americans, but they were. And there's a really interesting quote after they got back to the islands, and there was, you know, parties and parades and luaus and poems composed in their honor, hula composed in their honor, and you know, obviously it was a huge moment for Hawaii, and there's a quote from one of the newspapers where they say, these Paniolo have shown that Hawaii is more than a hula platform in the mid-Pacific. And so even though it had been absorbed into this massive empire, even though it was technically part of America, and they were technically Americans, they were still very much their own people and their own culture.
This is a wonderful book. I encourage you all to buy it and read it and enjoy it. It is immensely entertaining. I learned a ton about something I didn't know necessarily a ton about. Oh, that's amazing. Do you want to talk about that slide for a second? I didn't know you were going
to. This is just one of the newspapers advertising Frontier Days. It was a huge, huge deal. It was the biggest thing in the state, if not the Front Range of the Rockies at the time.
Yeah.
I think we have one more about the Hawaiian newspapers. When they return, this is a Hawaiian Honolulu Sunday Advertiser, and you know, their big picture smack in the middle of the front page. I mean, these guys were heroes. These guys were the first non-sports related heroes, international heroes in Hawaii. And they were treated that way too. And then there's a cover again.
There was a cover. All right, so now we're gonna finish. It is an immensely entertaining book. It's wonderful. I learned a ton. I think you guys will all enjoy it. So I encourage you to hang out. Get a copy, get these guys to sign it, ask them some more questions. And thanks to Powell's for having us. Thank you all for coming out. Have a great evening.
That was David Woolman and Julian Smith speaking at Powell's Books in May 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.